This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, the top experts, a big issue and 28 minutes, all brought together in the virtual space that is The Briefing Room. This week, what does the current economic turmoil in Britain mean for public spending? Turmoil. Everything changing. Yet out of it, we have to make some sense. As the government struggles with the aftermath of its mini-budget, its options include reining in public spending. As of now, the timetable is that they will be outlining their plans on the 31st of October, Halloween. So where are we with public spending right now? How have we got there? And what would be the impact on our services and benefits of any cuts? Step into the briefing room and find out. First, let's set the parameters of the government's problem. Paul Johnson is the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, or IFS, which this week published its own study of the choices the government faces. Paul Johnson, just to set the context for the current economic uncertainty, what in fiscal terms did the Chancellor announce in his mini-budget last month, and how does it fit in to his overall programme?
Well, the Chancellor announced a set of tax cuts which come to somewhat more than £40 billion a year into the medium run. That's a very big set of tax cuts. Indeed, in fact, as a fraction of the total economy, it's the biggest that we've seen in 50 years. And of course, it comes at a remarkably difficult moment. It comes at a point when inflation is very high, when the Bank of England is trying to damp that down. And it also comes at a point when the economy is pretty weak. And so borrowing was on the up in any case, partly because of this huge energy package, but partly because revenues in the longer run are going to come in more weakly because the economy is growing so poorly. So that he really threw a very unconventional policy into a very difficult economic environment.
The point is also, isn't it, is it was only half the business. I mean, in a conventional budget, what you get is the whole thing laid out, including public spending. But what he did was just the tax cuts bit of it.
Well, he didn't tell us anything about the public finances or public spending. He simply stood up and said, here's 40-odd billion pounds of tax cuts. And I think that, more than anything else, is what really scared and spooked the markets and created some of the difficulties that we've seen since.
Now, into that information gap left by the Chancellor leapt your own organisation, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and you published your own analysis of the government's figures. Now, remind us about your principal conclusions.
The key conclusions, and they're not in a sense terribly surprising, is that you've got these big tax cuts, you've got big extra spending coming on debt interest, on pensions and welfare and so on because of higher inflation and higher interest rates. That results in a big budget deficit each year going forward. And in particular, it results in, it looks like, the government's debt continuing to rise as a fraction of national income into the medium term. So that's another way of saying that the public finances look like they're on what we would call an unsustainable path. Now, it's important to say there's a huge amount of uncertainty about this. If the economy ends up doing much better, maybe the gas price crashes next year, then things may turn out rather rosier than that. But on a reasonable central assumption, it looks like the public finances are not on a sustainable path, and that will require either a reversal of a large fraction of the tax cuts we've just seen, or some remarkably painful public spending cuts.
Now, what can we reasonably estimate that sum to be? The sum that would either have to be found by reversing tax cuts or by public expenditure cuts or a combination of both?
A reasonable estimate would be we're looking at something in the 50, 60 billion pound mark. Now, again, depends what you're trying to achieve here. The most important thing in the short run is to regain credibility with the market. So our public finance forecasts are saying, well, look, in the medium run, you may need to tighten by a certain amount. The markets, I think, are looking for something even more quickly to say, look, we're actually going to respond to this and we're going to issue maybe less debt in the next year. And that might require a very quick reversal of policy. The Chancellor's got two things weighing on him. One is, what can he do in the near term to persuade the markets that he's taking some of this seriously? And also, what can he do in the longer term to ensure that the overall path is sustainable?
We'll come on to what those mean in a moment. But the key takeaway here, firstly, is that you can't just simply say, well, we're going to borrow more to fill this gap because markets essentially are not going to buy it. And the second thing is it fair to say, Paul, that you could make quite a simple calculation that the more you stick to your tax cuts, if you're the Chancellor, the more you're going to have to cut public expenditure?
Up to a point, yes, but it's only up to a point, because he could say, look, I'm going to stick to my tax cuts, but I'm going to cut public expenditure in 5 years' time. But no one's going to believe that. I mean, that's 3 years after the next election, and that is not in itself anything credible that you can say to the world. I think it requires some action in the short run. And as I say, that might involve reversing some or all of the tax cuts. It might involve coming up with some fairly dramatic spending cuts in the near term, which of course is incredibly hard. It's hard politically because you're going to find it hard to get through Parliament. And it's hard from a social and economic point of view because it's quite hard to think of what those cuts would be, which wouldn't have significantly damaging effect. We'd probably be talking about a substantial cut, for example, in welfare benefits, or a substantial cut in the kind of money that's being spent on public services, of the kind which would be really hard to implement. But the counterfactual is, if he doesn't do any of that, then we are at best stuck with these much higher interest rates and the turmoil we've got on the financial markets, which are going to hit all of us very hard. I think the other big thing that Chancellor could be thinking about is we've got far and away the biggest energy support package of pretty much any country. It's completely untargeted. Some way of reducing the cost of that would help, or even actually some way of recouping the cost of that. So we're all facing average energy bills of £2,500 over the next year. Chancellor could say, well, look, we're going to keep average energy bills at £2,500 into the indefinite future, even when energy prices come down. Not politically popular, but that will be quite a good way of recouping a lot of money.
Okay, so if they decide that that's really not something they really want to tell the electorate at the moment, and they still do want to stick to their tax cuts, you've given this figure of a £60 billion worth of cuts that might be needed. Is that to be regarded as a worst-case scenario, or is that broadly realistic?
Is it a worst-case scenario? No, it's not a worst-case scenario. I mean, it is clearly possible that the economy could do worse than we're projecting. There's all sorts of problems facing us. I think what we were talking about was a reasonable central case. And of course, if that's a reasonable central case, things could turn out a lot better, but they could certainly turn out worse as well.
Paul, on Wednesday, the Prime Minister suggested she was carrying on with the tax cuts and also ruled out any cuts in public expenditure. Can you think of any way she can square that circle?
Hard to see how. I mean, you could redefine a cut as a cut in cash terms, because obviously with inflation being very high, if you just spend the same cash amount over time, the real value of that goes down quite fast. And you could say, well, that's not a cut. You know, I'm spending X hundred billion this year, and I'm still spending X hundred billion next year. But of course, we all know that will be worth less.
Now, we're making this programme specifically about public spending and the outlook for public spending and the choices the government has to make about it. What do you suspect that the government is thinking about this?
We know that they're going to different departments looking for cuts. I mean, they're asking the Department for Work and Pensions, are there ways we could save significant amounts on the benefits bill? You could look actually at investment spending, capital spending, which by historic standards in the UK is actually a very high level, the highest level it's been for more than 40 years. In fact, the highest level it's been in modern times when we haven't been invested in nationalised industries and so on. But that doesn't sit very well with a government that's absolutely focused on growth. And then you look at what are the big areas of spending? The biggest area of spending is the NHS by far. Are we really going to cut spending on the NHS? I don't think so. Pensions, well, that is one thing that the Prime Minister has committed to increasing. Education. Again, you can't cut spending on education and say you're focused on growth. And the next biggest area is defence. And the Prime Minister has actually promised to increase spending on defence by 50%.
So, Paul, is there anything that the government can do in kind of political terms, I mean, up to and including a change of personnel at the top, which might reassure the markets?
Well, I think part of the problem the markets are facing has been the level of political uncertainty and chopping and changing that we've seen. What happened with the mini budget, in a sense, was the straw that broke the camel's back. I mean, the UK has not been behaving terribly well for some period of time with the political uncertainty. It is, if you want growth, if you want stability in the markets, the first, foremost, and most important thing you need is political stability, macroeconomic stability, and trust in your institutions. And unless I think the markets saw a change of personnel as a movement towards greater stability, which they might, it's not clear that it would have a big positive effect. It might just reinforce the idea that this is a government which is not providing the stability that they're looking for.
Paul Johnson. Next, I want to find out more about how much we spend, what we spend it on, and the recent history of trying to restrict spending. Soumaya Keynes is UK economics editor at The Economist. Soumaya Keynes, can we try and establish a kind of baseline for UK public spending? How much does the government spend and what does it spend it on?
Roughly speaking, the government spends about £1 trillion a year. That is around 40% of GDP, right? That's not small change there. And if you're thinking about how it's divided up between areas, roughly speaking, again, around half is spent on public services. So that's things like the NHS, schools, transport, justice, those kinds of things. And around half is spent on other stuff. And that other stuff includes the welfare bill. It includes debt interest payments, public sector pensions, that sort of thing.
So if we spend £1 trillion, that's £1,000 billion.
Yes.
Wow. Let's look back at the last time a government found it necessary to make major cuts. And we talk a lot about austerity, which is the period after the financial crisis of 2008-09 and so on. And a new government comes in committed to austerity. Can you remind us about the scale of the cuts that government felt it was necessary to make?
Yeah, I mean, they were enormous. What had happened is in the global financial crisis, the economy took a massive beating, tax revenues tanked, and forecasters were predicting a kind of structural hole in the public finances. And the size of that was, you know, something like 8% of GDP, right? Really, really big. And the coalition government back in 2010 decided that they would mostly fill it through spending cuts, not tax increases.
Now, by and large, where did those spending cuts fall?
I think maybe an easier way of answering that is to say where they didn't fall, right? So there were various large areas of spending that were relatively protected. Right. One of those was spending on the NHS. Another one was day-to-day spending on schools. Another one was pensioner benefits, right? State pensions, that kind of thing. And that meant that the other areas of spending have much, much larger than average cuts, right? And so those fell on benefits for the working age population. They fell on departments like, you know, the Home Office, Ministry of Justice, current spending on transport, Department for Work and Pensions, the departments kind of delivering those non-education, non-health public services.
And are those what we mean when we talk about the low-hanging fruit?
I think it is possible that back in 2010, there was some fat to be trimmed from the system, right? And so one could call some of that low-hanging fruit. At the beginning, there was a major cancellation of capital spending projects. That was a relatively easy thing to cut at first.
But when you cancel something like capital spending, does that mean that, for example, you don't spend money on repairing schools, even if you keep up the day-to-day budget of the schools?
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And so now one of the pressures we're facing is kind of fairly dilapidated schools infrastructure that the government is trying to fix.
After the period of austerity was declared over, were there some areas of public spending which have never fully recouped from the period of austerity?
Yes, absolutely. If you look at, say, the Department for Work and Pensions or the Department for Transport, even with the real terms increases planned up to 2024-25 under the Rishi Sunak plans, those departments were still all expected to have budgets that were at least around a third smaller than they were in 2010.
Right. So that's where we had got to before the government's most recent fiscal event and the spending plans, which are to be announced on Halloween. We've heard from the Institute of Fiscal Studies that they think the government has a £60 billion actual gap and might need to find tens of billions of cuts in the next 4 years. How do those compare in scale with the austerity cuts?
The size of the fiscal hole that the IFS is describing is not as big as the one that was being faced in 2010, right? The other difference is that a lot of it is self-imposed. The government increased the size of its own hole by announcing these fairly large tax cuts. The difference is, though, that we've now had this long period of trimming fat, right? And so it is just much harder to imagine what you could do that wouldn't really drastically change what the government would be providing in terms of services.
So, Mayor Keynes, now let's look, by way of example, at one of the biggest areas of public spending, health and social care. Anita Charlesworth is Director of Research at the Health Foundation. Anita Charlesworth, can you remind us what the current NHS budget in England is for this year and then take us forward for the next few years?
Yes. So for the NHS in England, the budget is almost £152 billion. That budget will increase basically by £5 billion a year. So in 2 years' time, it'll be just shy of £163 billion.
Right. Now, how much of the budget at the moment goes on staff?
It's probably getting up for two-thirds.
Now, was the settlement that you talked about earlier, was it reached anticipating high inflation?
No. Two of the key assumptions have proved not to be true. One is that inflation would be low and therefore pay settlements would be low. So the assumption was about 2% inflation, pay rises of 2%, maybe 3% maximum. The other key assumption for the NHS is that basically COVID would be over. But COVID isn't over. On an average week, 10,000 hospital beds have got someone in them who has COVID.
OK, so what's actually happened to the kind of inflation that the health service faces? And do we have any projection for going forward in the next year or so?
So what NHS England said at the beginning of October when they ran their numbers is when they work through energy costs, the fact that the pay award for staff this year was about closer to 5% than the 2 to 3%, they reckon they're 6 to 7 billion short of what they would need this year in order to deliver on the commitments that were made back in 2021 when that funding envelope was set.
The increase in the national insurance contribution was supposed to be a significant factor in contributing to the NHS's shortfall, and then in later years, as I understand it, to social care budget. But Parliament has just voted not to have the NICS
increase. Has that worried people about whether or not the money going forward will actually be there?
If we worry about the NHS, actually, if you talk to most people in the NHS and you say, if there was any money around, what would you do with it? Most of them say, please, please, please give it to social care. Because actually, we can see the harm it's doing to people. But the issues for social care are not just that. They're in the actual core funding of the system, and come back to that really important issue of pay. Wages in social care are not rising in line with retail in hospitality. They're falling behind. And as a result of that, actually, the number of people working in social care is falling for about the first time, despite the ageing population.
Right. Now, the picture you're painting is one in which, if the NHS does face a real term cut, i.e. it's simply not compensated for the effect of inflation, then in that case, we are going to face increased pressure right the way across the system.
So anything happens, a bad flu, NHS is really worried about this winter, and we've got no room in our system to cope.
Is this position the same, as far as you know, for the other home nations?
Well, so the underlying challenges are the same for the other home nations. Everyone is squeezed between rising input costs from pay and inflation, and then COVID not going away, and this huge, huge issue of the backlog of care in terms of planned operations, mental health and general practice, which we haven't talked about, being under huge strain.
Anita, one of the things that I imagine the government will be very keen to do is to suggest that whatever else it protects the health and social care budget. We've looked at some aspects of that. That might mean significantly bigger cuts elsewhere. And I'm aware from doing previous programmes that some of those can actually themselves have quite a big knock-on effect for the NHS.
Yeah, so there are lots of people as well at the moment are talking about this winter with cost of living and particularly older people and fuel poverty, about creating warm banks and the role that local authorities, library services and all those things will play in ensuring people can be warm. I guess the other thing to think about is things like the availability of childcare. It's really important for our staff to be able to come to work in the NHS. So all of those interdependencies are important.
I talked to somebody in the ambulance service not so long ago, and one of the things they said is that you can tell when, say, local drug services have been run down and when other coping parts of the service have been run down. Is that felt in the NHS more generally?
Every time you talk to a GP, they say, we're just working harder than we've ever worked. We're answering the phone all day long, but we know we've got hundreds of calls that we're not getting to. And when we look at who's trying to get through to this, a lot of those issues are debt, housing and the mental health issues that then flow on from that. A&E is reporting the same. These services are becoming the public services of last resort, the one bit of the system that can't turn you away, but, you know, not actually equipped for some of these problems. It's not the right place. And then also, obviously, it means that the people who actually need healthcare advice can't get through. When you run down all the other services, that's what you're left with, a public service of last resort.
Anita Charlesworth. So where do we get to, or rather, where does the government get to when we put all that together? My final guest in the briefing room this week is Gemma Tetlow, Chief Economist at the Institute of Government. Gemma Tetlow, can we start by looking at social protection? I think that's what the government now calls social security and pensions together, the largest area of government spending. How does that area break down roughly between its component parts?
At the moment, we spend about £250 billion a year on welfare spending, social security spending, and that breaks down roughly 50-50 between spending on pensioners and spending on people of working age. And within the spending on people of working age, a little over half of that is on things like universal credit, those benefits for low-income people both in and out of work. And the other half, most of that goes on disability benefits.
Okay, so let's look at pensions first. Under the spending plans previous to whatever we're going to find out from the Chancellor at the end of October, what was expected to happen to them over the next few years?
The biggest component of that, the state pension, is intended to go up by what's known as the triple lock. So that means that every year state pension incomes go up by the highest of inflation, earnings growth, or 2.5%. Certainly next April, the biggest of those numbers will be inflation, which in September, which is the relevant number, was running over 10%.
How much could the government potentially save by changing those arrangements, by getting rid of the triple lock and having some other form of index for the increase in pensions?
If you were to index the state pension by earnings growth rather than inflation next April, that could save you about £4 billion a year. If you did it for a second year, you could save about £7 billion a year from 2024 onwards. Quite a sizable amount of money.
This may seem the most kind of obvious questions, but that's politically tricky.
Certainly, the perceived wisdom is that pensioners are more likely to vote, and therefore all political parties are perhaps more concerned about how pensioners might see policy than working age and younger adults.
Working age benefits don't have a triple lock, but the plans up until now suggest that they should increase in line with inflation, I believe. What would happen if the government were to change that and, say, uprate them according to earnings? How much would that save?
If you did that for all working age benefits, that could save about £7 billion a year if you did it for 1 year in 2023. If you did it for 2 years, you could save around £13 billion a year from 2024 onwards.
So that would be quite a substantial contribution, but again, politically fraught.
It is politically difficult because that would mean taking money away compared to expectations from people on the lowest incomes. And whilst Liz Truss has been keen to emphasise one of her rationales for this being the question of should people who are out of work have their incomes rising more quickly than people who are in work if earnings growth is below inflation. But actually a lot of people who receive those working age benefits actually are in work as well. So we're not just talking about workless households here. This would be reducing incomes of low income working households.
That shows the trickiness of those particular areas. Now, one of the other areas which has been talked about is the possibility of cutting back public investment, which is currently at quite a high level.
Boris Johnson had set the government on a course to much higher levels of public investment than we've been used to in recent decades. And his ambition was that the government should be investing 3% of national income on average every year. So cutting investment spending back wouldn't be unprecedented for the UK, but it's also potentially a difficult decision to make for this government that has gone so strong on emphasising the need for economic growth, because investment spending is a lot of what is likely to then drive future economic growth. If you're improving the quality of transport infrastructure, new railways, but also things like the infrastructure that other public services need to deliver quality services. So new hospital buildings, things like, we have quite an ambitious programme of work underway in the court system to try and bring the courts more into the 21st century with more digital technology. So all those sorts of things could be affected if you scaled back public investment plans.
Right. So we've looked at some of the key areas of public spending, and frankly, we're not having much luck here. From an economist's point of view, what is it the government should do?
The government needs to get back into a position where the public finances are on a sustainable path. That means debt falling rather than rising as a share of national income within a few years. There are three ways of doing that. You can cut spending to match the sorts of tax revenues that are now expected. You can raise taxes. Most obvious might be to reverse some of the measures that were announced in the mini budget, but you could raise taxes in other ways instead. And or you could try and massage the debt figures to superficially make it look like things are better. In the past, financial markets haven't paid, I would say, that close attention to the detail of government's fiscal plans. I think the danger for this government is that following the shock of the mini budget and the turmoil in financial markets since, people are paying much closer attention to the detail of their plans than they have been in the past. And therefore, I think it's much more likely this time that they need to show some actual action on either public spending or taxes or both, and won't simply be able to get away with some clever jigging of the other numbers.
That sort of suggests that you would recommend to Kwasi Kwarteng that the least he should do, or might do, is a combination of reversing tax cuts and some judicious public expenditure cutting.
Some combination of tax rises, either reversing what's been announced or something else, or significant cuts to public spending compared to the current plans, will be required to put the public finances back on a sustainable course.
Gemma Tetlow. My conclusion? I might not have started from here. My thanks to Gemma Tetlow, Paul Johnson, Sumaya Keynes and Anita Charlesworth. We'll be back next week. We hope. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Octavia Woodward, Daniel Gordon and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Rod Farker and the editor was Penny Murphy. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to our look at the UK economy's long-term productivity problem. And there's also a programme about whether Britain might run out of power this winter.
Are you fed up
with the news?
The top jobs in the new cabinet have all gone to
horses of apocalypse.
And I loved it.
The skewer.
The skewer.
The skewer.
The news chopped and channeled.
Don't make her angry.
I will crush the British people.
You wouldn't like her when she's angry.
Well, there's nothing new about a Labour leader.
Who the hell are you?
Liz Truss.
She-Hulk.
Who is calling for more tax rises.
It's everything you need to know.
Like you've never heard it before.
Thousands of lesbians were striking today in a dispute over pay. The three-day walkout could delay the processing of up to 60,000. Gay women.
The biggest story.
Next. With a twist. A
surge in food prices.
Coming up.
Washing up liquid.
£3,000 to £5,000.
Right.
A packet of custard creams.
Where did you get them?
They were in a box in my mother-in-law's cupboard.
Sort of £300 to £400, something like that.
Michael Holmes.
Crack team.
Sound wizards.
You're a wizard.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.